and welcome to the podcast where you will heal the relationship with yourself, unlearn the limiting beliefs that tell you it's better to blend in than stand out, and realize that you are more than enough. You are incredible. I am your host, Susan Padron, an intuitive personal stylist and award-winning author featured in InStyle and many publications accessible all over the world. I am a tattooed queer mom who is showing up to give you the gentle nudge or emotional hug, whichever you need, so that you can give yourself the permission to be you. This is the Susan Padron Podcast. Hello, hello, and welcome back to the Susan Padron Podcast. Today, I have a wonderful guest that I cannot wait to share with you, and her name is Aliza Stamps, and she is a licensed clinical social worker and author of the book, The Gaslighting Recovery Journal. She also hosts a podcast entitled, Am I the Crazy One? That is described as a romp through the colorful world of narcissism and all things cluster B. Aliza specializes in working with adult children of narcissists and is the founder of the support and recovery group for these individuals entitled Shattering the Mirror. She also has experience treating eating disorders and complex trauma. Postgraduate work includes training in Gestalt therapy, internal family systems therapy, and certification in Dr. McBride's 5-step recovery model for treating adult children of narcissistic parents. Aliza received a Bachelor's of Music Education degree from the University of Wisconsin-Madison and received her Master of Social Service degree from Bryn Mawr's College Graduate School of Social Work and Social Research. Aliza, I'm really excited for our conversation today. I know we've been following each other on Instagram for a bit, but I think you first reached out to me right after I launched my podcast and around the time when I was getting ready to host a workshop that was all around, right, you know, like body issues. So disordered eating and body issues are topics that come up a lot with my personal styling clients. Can you share, you know, how did you get into working as a social worker and what made you specifically focus on disordered eating and adult children of narcissists?
Yes, sure. So my road, and thank you so much for having me, by the way, I am thrilled to be here. So,
yay.
Thanks. It was kind of, you know, I'm a career changer, so I've had many past lives. I was a vocal and general music education teacher and director for a while, and then was a musical theater performer and around the Philly and Lancaster areas. And, you know, definitely noticed things about body image and, you know, eating, especially in that arena. And then made the choice to go on to grad school and was fortunate enough to go to Bryn Mawr. So one of my initial like field placements was at the Renfrew Center and working with folks struggling with eating disorders and body image and whatnot. And so that was a really big area of interest to me, both professionally and personally. And then what I was noticing in my work as I moved, you know, from working at an inpatient facility to then at a group practice was that there seemed to be this intersection between eating disorders and then folks coming from these narcissistic family systems, which absolutely can be a manifestation when we've grown up in these narcissistic systems. So then I sort of married the two, and that's how the specialties were kind of born.
Wow. Yeah, I know you and I were talking before we started to record this episode, but I feel like the majority of the emotional issues that I see with my clients, my personal styling clients, really stem from body issues and like disordered eating behavior, as well as narcissistic relationships. And I feel like that both of those umbrellas just take on all of those issues that my clients come to on their own, usually before we start working together. And it really makes a lot of sense that there is that connection between them. And so how does a narcissistic relationship or a parent really then kind of evolve into a disordered eating with the child? Like, how do you see that kind of happen?
Sure. Yeah, I mean, and I want to say too that I use narcissism as sort of a spectrum, right? Like,
yes,
you know, shallow end of the swimming pool, deep end of the swimming pool. And also, I kind of throw in the cluster B elements in there. So perhaps borderline personality disorder, histrionic. But generally, you know, the core fear of the narcissist is the fear of abandonment, real or perceived. So that's where this idea of kind of the control that they need comes in. They also are quite unaware of their own emotional internal worlds and really despise themselves, even though sometimes it seems like quite the opposite. So they will take a lot of that, and I'm, you know, kind of thinking in terms of narcissistic mothers and daughters, and then they'll project what I call project vomited onto their target, in this case, their child, and then attack, 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 right? So some of the things that they are placing onto their child are most likely their stuff, but it's done at such an early age that the child doesn't know the difference. And so the core belief that a child growing up in this family system walks away with is this feeling of not good enough. And they can try to be good enough in so many ways. One of those is, you know, being thin enough, being pretty enough, being, you know, pleasing to the eye enough, so on and so on and so on. And that's where the idea of an eating disorder and the two kind of come together.
Wow. That makes so much sense. especially just, I'm thinking about so many of the clients that I've worked with over the years. And, you know, we hear in the fashion world, right? We hear a lot of like, well, growing up, or my mom told me that I could only wear this or this, or like my mom would never let me walk out of the house wearing this because she would say, you know, if my stomach isn't totally flat, then I can't wear it. And it really does come from like how the mom felt about herself and her body. And then project, project vomiting, right? Is that like the term that you used, like that onto the kid?
Right.
It really is that projected view, that really harmful projected view of themselves onto their child. And I think some of the statistics that I've heard about the age when kids, and please feel free to correct me if I'm wrong about this, but the age that kids start to think critically or negatively about their own bodies, like, can start as young as like 6, I think. And I'm sure it can even start younger than that too, depending on their, you know, what they're exposed to. But to think about that, like 6 years old, and they're already having these thoughts about the way that they look and their bodies and comparing themselves to other people, it's heartbreaking for me to like think about that.
And I don't think the medical profession, quite frankly, at this time is always doing people any favors either, because I think American Pediatrics Association could be completely getting the organization wrong on this, but I know that they have now approved, you know, gastric bypass for young children, medications for weight loss for young children. And it's, to me, it's going in such an opposite direction of the way it needs to go. So that in conjunction with growing up in these family systems and then just in our society, you know, it's a perfect storm for eating disorders down the road.
Right. Yeah, absolutely. It's so sad. And I agree. It's like going in the wrong direction entirely. It's like, okay, I understand, like, for health purposes, fine, like treatment, you know, if that needs to, if there needs to be some kind of medical intervention, but like at what cost, right? Like at what point do you really need to approve such an extreme surgery or like surgical treatment for such a young child? And how does that impact them, like their mental health moving forward? Yikes. Yikes, indeed.
And, you know, like a diet or even these recommendations now for younger children, nothing, not one of those things actually addresses the underlying origin of the root cause, which is the relationship with food.
Right. Oh my gosh. Yes. The relationship with food. Oh my goodness. Like diet culture. I cannot. I have not like really spoken about this on the podcast yet, but whew, today might be that day. I have this complete repulsion towards diet culture. I think that it is so toxic. I think that it usually ends up backfiring for a lot of people. And it's because of exactly what you said. Like, a diet does not address the relationship with food, which if you're not thinking about, like, okay, well, why do you binge? Like, or why do you feel like you need to, you know, abstain from eating? Or what is it about, like, how much or how little you're eating, and why mentally, you know, from a psychology perspective, like, what's going on there? And where is that coming from? Where's the root of that? Then I don't care what diet you try. It might work for a little bit. Great. But long term, no. Like, you've got to work. You got to do the inner mindset work in order to make the change. But obviously, you are the expert. So please share. Yeah. Tell me. Tell me your thoughts.
Yeah. We're headed in this direction. Yeah, absolutely. And diets work until they don't. Why? Yes. Because they have you right to lose weight. The only way that that's possible is to do restriction according to a diet. Mm-hmm. And the body, when we're eating in a well-rounded way, the body will naturally find its happy place.
Yeah.
But, you know, anybody who's dieted knows you hit that plateau, you drop the weight fast, you hit the plateau, and then sometimes you stay there or even gain weight. Why? Because the body thinks it's starving. So it's going to clamp down on everything that it has left. That's why diets work until they don't. They know that they don't work. They're counting on you coming back and feeling even more defeated and feeling even more self-blame. So then you spend more money.
Right.
You know, and I know there's a whole Ozempic, Wegovy craze right now. I mean, everybody's doing it, right?
Yeah.
And I am not passing judgment. I understand that I have the privilege of speaking from being in a mid-sized body. So I totally understand that. And I validate that. But these are diet tools again. They were designed for people initially with diabetes.
Right.
Now they're being used for diet. If you stop taking it at any point, you will gain the weight back.
Yeah.
And the longitudinal studies haven't been done yet. So we really don't know the long-term effects on things like the pancreas, you know, and other aspects of it.
Sure.
So there's my two cents about that world.
Yeah, I appreciate it. I appreciate you sharing your wisdom in that world for sure. Ozempic. I have clients, gonna not call them out by name, but I'm calling them out because they know I'm not like thrilled. Not that it's my place. It's not my judgment. I understand that. But while we're on the topic, like, I have clients who have started using Ozempic exclusively for weight loss, you know, as many people are. And they are folks who were like, well, I used to be a size 2, but I put on some weight and now I'm a 6 and I don't like that. And I'm going to call bullshit on that, like, right there. And I'm sorry if they have underlying health issues that they have since discovered, since I learned about that. My apologies. I sit corrected. But I strongly disagree with doing that kind of harm to yourself, to your body, when it's clearly an underlying issue. Like, it's not about being healthy. It's not even about losing the weight. It's about how you feel about your body and about yourself and the self-worth that you attach to your size or how much you weigh. And that's where I get angry and frustrated.
Yeah. And also, and I am a middle-aged woman, right? My body is experiencing changes. Absolutely. Sure. Changes that I cannot control. And I will be the first to tell people too, I have a long history of disordered eating myself. Mm-hmm. And so I get it. It feels very much out of our control. We feel like, what am I doing wrong?
Yeah.
Here's a quick magic pill, right? It's not lost on me either that this has to be injected into the stomach, which is a part of the body that often people have such a love-hate relationship with.
Right.
I just tell people, like, do the research before you do it. And why does it work? Here's why it works. Because it delays gastric emptying.
Right.
So, like, it's, you're not really full and you're not really thinking about, you know, oh, I don't have thoughts of food. Well, no, because you're so uncomfortable from, you know, gastric stuff happening.
Yeah.
Okay. And let me just say, I did see the Barbie movie last night too. So I maybe am coming in hot from that, but, there was such a beautiful moment, you know, and why is it that we don't embrace the aging process? Why don't we give support to people rather than saying, here, take this shot, take this diet, you know?
Right.
Anyway.
Yeah.
I could go on for hours.
So could I. I mean, like, you can see how, like, riled up I got. I mean, I am just ready to, like, take this fight on. But I do appreciate you sharing just, you know, how you've been helping your patients and the people that you're working with through making these kinds of decisions and, you know, doing the research. Like, absolutely, if you're going to inject anything in your body, like, theoretically, like, do the research. You know, speaking of someone who has tattoos and has done, like, zero research on, like, tattoo ink. So I understand, hypocritical in this moment, but
I will join that because I am full of tattoos too and never really thought twice about that either. So yeah. I'm with you there.
I had another thought of what I wanted to kind of bring up with you. And that is around the fact, we're just going to take, like, a quick little pivot because I got excited about this when I was reading your bio. And that is that you were also a former music teacher, which I did not realize until I saw your bio. I too am a former music teacher and am no longer. Clearly. But yeah, I taught middle school band. I also taught general music. So I feel like I see you. I'm sorry for what you experienced. Anyone who has taught music, I feel like understands right now. But what grade levels did you teach?
Well, you know, I taught all grade levels. And I've taught everything from kindergarten and then having my own classroom and then music on a cart, which a lot of people don't realize that, you know, I mean, I hope people realize the arts aren't generally prioritized. So guess what? You don't get a room and you get to try and teach music from a cart wheeling all over the school. But my last job before I had my daughter was as a high school vocal music director. And I actually, I really loved that age. I loved my students. I actually ran into a former student recently, and this is from like 10 plus, no, my gosh, well, more than 10 plus years ago, more like probably 15 years ago. And, you know, it was wonderful to see that, like, there was still the memory of each other and the impact that the arts and music can have on people's lives. So I really did love my high school kids.
Yeah.
But I think not so much that red tape of it all, not so much.
Yes, exactly. Exactly. 100%. Like, loved the kids, loved teaching music, the red tape, the administrative issues, like, absolutely not. I would never go back to teaching because of that. Like, I have no desire to ever go back, and which is sad, but also I love what I do now. So it all works out, right? Like, I love how you said in the beginning, how you've jumped, you've done different careers and how that's been fulfilling. And I feel the same way. It's like different seasons of life. Sometimes we need to change things up and help at different stages of our own healing, right? Like, I mean, you mentioned how you yourself struggled with disordered eating, and now you're at a point in your healing journey where you're able to help so many folks through that, which is really incredible.
Thank you. Yeah. Everything that I've done, I always say, has led me to this career. And I kind of take everything from other careers and implement it here, which is really cool to get to do.
Yeah, definitely. I think there's so much that I learned from being a teacher that has definitely supported me through, like, becoming a personal stylist, any kind of public speaking, even parenting. Like, I mean, I taught for years before we had our son, and my husband was a former high school music teacher as well. And there are definitely things that we've picked up on from being teachers that we're like, okay, yes, this is, there's a direct correlation between like any kind of, you know, threat of consequence, right? Like the following through that has to happen, the consequences that have to match the crime, so to speak. And that has made parenting easier. Not that parenting is easy, but being a former teacher made parenting easier.
Yes. Yes. Definitely. I fully agree.
Yeah. So a lot of my clients, they don't necessarily use like the terms. I want to backtrack to narcissism for a bit. So my clients don't necessarily use the language around narcissism to describe the relationships that they have, like especially with their parents. But I've absolutely witnessed it. Like I've seen that, you know, the way that they're describing it, it clearly sounds, at least to me, like to someone who is not a specialist, but has like a basic level of narcissistic behavior. That's what it sounds like to me. And, you know, a lot of that work that we do together really surrounds just helping my clients to give themselves permission to make choices on their own and knowing that they will be okay with going through and like following through with those choices. Like, even if it's just the choices around clothing, you know, of course it kind of evolves into life choices too, because we spend a lot of time together, a lot of vulnerable moments. Like, so it's just more than just clothes, but it usually starts at allowing them to give themselves the permission to make those choices. And is that something that you see often with your clients too, in the work that you do?
I think 100%, right? This lack of autonomy, even if they had engulfing narcissistic parent versus a neglectful narcissistic parent, right? There are these rules of engagement in the family system. If we don't follow these rules of engagement, right, it can be seen as betrayal in the family. It can be seen as abandonment, that, you know, the narcissist can perceive it as abandonment. And I think also when there is this projection of, you know, emotional needs, body, whatever, the child's role is to just fulfill the wishes and the likes and dislikes of the narcissistic parents. So I think a lot of times too, folks don't know, like even when you ask them, well, what do you want? What do you like? Oh, I don't know. I never had that opportunity to even think about that. Right. So I think there
I'm
is that.
I'm shaking my head so hard right now.
You are. Yes. I am. That right, like when you say to a, well, what's your favorite? Oh gosh, I don't know. I didn't even know that I got the choice. You know.
Yeah. And oh my gosh, just I'm envisioning like specific clients that I've had where, you know, I'll say to them, I'll be like, oh well, you know, they'll like, what outfit do you like best? And like they can't tell me. And it's not because they don't like anything. You know, they clearly like throughout the whole process, they're like, oh my gosh, like, yeah, this looks great. Right. Like they're constantly like looking to me for that validation, which I also understand. Right. Like I am the expert in the situation. They're hiring me for my opinion. But when I'm like, well, which one was your favorite? Like they kind of can't make that choice sometimes. Or what really like just weighs on my heart is when I am speaking with a potential new client for the first time. And I always love to start out by asking them, you know, just tell me about yourself. Like, just tell me about yourself. And some of them, you know, they get into it. They tell me about like what they do for work. They tell me about their family. They tell me like a whole beautiful, like mini life story. And I love it. And other people, they almost shut down. Because they just turn into, like, they freeze, right? Like, that would be the the psychological, you know, response of being in that state of freeze, like, that panic. Like, what do you want to know? Like, and I'm like, just tell me anything. Like, whatever you want. Tell me about you. And they can't respond.
I know.
And it makes me so sad because like, how do you live your life as a fully functioning, successful adult to the point where you want to hire a personal stylist, right? And you completely shut down at the question or just the prompt of someone asking you to tell them about you.
Ugh. Yeah. And that's, you know, I feel like we should open a business, like therapies.
Right? I love
it. And a narcissist. Yeah. Because, right, like I get the same, you know, folks come to me. By the time usually folks come to me, they have an inkling that maybe they come from a narcissistic family system. They've done the research, they come to me. But even when we start a session and I'll say, where do you want to begin today? Do you want to breathe? Do you want to start? Oh, I don't. Well, what do you think? Well, it's not, you know, I'm not, this is for you. This is your time. What I think, you know, you are the expert in you. And so I really hope that the work that I do with folks begins to give them more of a sense of self, self energy, and that they can eventually really find their authentic selves through the work that we're doing. That's my one of my biggest objectives for folks.
Yeah. I love that so much. Yeah. It's very much aligned with the work that I do too, where it's just giving them the tools that they need to be able to just be themselves, like to freely, unapologetically be themselves. And I strongly believe that therapy plays a huge role in that. Like, I know that it's not just the work that I do with my clients. A lot of them are either currently in therapy while we're working together. Actually, most of them just are. I was going to say where they were previously in therapy, but a lot of my clients are in therapy, which is great. I think everybody needs therapy. Like, if not all the time, at least at one or multiple phases of their lives, therapy is so crucial for just life, like for just life. And I remember speaking to some members of my family about other members of my family that were in therapy, and we're like, this is great. Really happy about that. And just casually saying to that family member, like, you know, like you should do therapy. And it wasn't meant to be like a critical thing. And they got so defensive. And I was like, no, like this is not, it's not a criticism. It was relevant to the conversation we were having too. And just about how they were struggling with processing some things that were going on. And I was like, hey, have you like thought about doing therapy? And they were like, why? Do you think I need it? And I was like, well, yeah, doesn't everybody? Like, but it was a generational thing, you know, and that's what's also tough.
Yeah, sometimes, you know, that, and this is pretty much true. I think a lot of times what it takes for folks to finally make that call or send that email to a therapist is, you know, crisis.
Yeah.
But as a gestalt therapist, you know, our belief is really like therapy isn't about just for the sick, just for the mentally ill, people's mental wellness. It's about enhancing your contact with your world, your relationships, yourself.
Right.
And I think it's pretty hard to do that alone.
Yeah, for sure.
People will often ask me too, like, well, how long do you think I'll need? I don't know. I mean, like, let's not time limit on it. You are deserving of this time for yourself and to, you know, strengthen the connection within yourself. So.
Exactly. It's not like physical therapy, right? Where you get to a point where you're physically strong enough and you don't need the treatment anymore to benefit your healing. Like emotional healing it's a journey, and there are definitely multiple stages to it. Some that require more outside support than others. And I hear that and I support that like completely. I understand too. Like I'm an elder millennial, and I know that millennials are like, hey, I'm on Cymbalta. What are you on? You know, or like, oh, you're in therapy once a week. Great. Oh, I had to go for like twice a week for a little bit. Now I'm on every other, you know, like we just speak freely about it because we want to eliminate the stigma around it. And, but I know that that's difficult sometimes for people who were raised differently, even you know, there might be other millennials like myself who their parents or their just their immediate family and friends, their support system is just not supportive of the idea around therapy. But that's just,
I think culturally too, right? Sure. Various cultures have, there can be a stigma and, you know, age, but I think it is wonderful. Like millennials, my daughter's Gen Z, like they talk very freely about therapy. Oh, do you have your appointment this week? And all of that stuff. And my goodness, in the world we're living in with what we've all been through collectively, if it hasn't affected you, I am quite surprised. So
yeah, I completely, completely agree with you. I mean, my son is 8 and a half and we started him in therapy last year. And it was because he was experiencing a lot of anxiety. I also experience anxiety as an adult, but I've dealt with anxiety since I was his age. So I remember, you know, what it was like to be a young kid having anxiety attacks and not knowing how to navigate that or having all of these really intense feelings. So as soon as I started to see those signs with him, you know, it's like, we're gonna go to therapy for a bit, you know, before the school year starts so that you can start developing those skills and the tools that you need to support you with this journey that you're on. Because in his 8 years of life so far, he's experienced a lot, you know, like we all have, to your point. And the, you know, there's so much that of course, like my husband and I can do to help him. But when I felt like I kind of exhausted my tools, it's like, we need to bring in a professional because I don't want him to continue growing up in this very fragile, malleable phase of life, thinking that being anxious the way that he is his only option. And I think that even adults get caught up in that.
Yes, yes. And I think it's wonderful what you and your husband did for your son. And, you know, it also illustrates the point that it's okay to ask for help and support. And this is what help and support can look like. And there is no shame in that. It doesn't mean we're weak. Mm-hmm. Again, it's really hard to do this life alone without support.
100%. And those were all really important lessons that we wanted to just plant the seed for at this phase of his life, you know, and hopefully it, you know, it stays with him. But if it needs to be, you know, something that we remind him of, that's okay too. But I love that, you know, he's 8 and he talks so pleasantly about his experience in therapy. And he will talk about it with his friends. And we talk about, you know, some of our friends who are adults that have experienced, you know, who are dealing with mental health issues. And just, again, like removing the stigma, talking about it, like you talk about some kind of physical ailment, because that's not all that different and it doesn't need to be different. And I just, I just want him to grow up and know that he can talk about how he's feeling. He can ask for help when he needs it and what support can look like in a variety of ways. So he never feels like he's lost or has to do it himself.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. And it, you know, we see there, I mean, I'm a somatic therapist too, so I really see the connection, the body and mind connection. Yeah. And we know that there's so much that we hold in the bodies too. And so it is beneficial to our physical health also to tap into some of what we are noticing and to really make that body mind connection, the whole person.
Absolutely. I mean, growing up as like a young kid, I had migraines from the time that I was like, don't know, 12. I had acid reflux. You know, talk about how the body just holds on to that stress and anxiety. Like, that's just what, I can absolutely speak to that. And embracing things like a regular yoga practice and meditation practice and breath work and all of that has absolutely helped in, you know, my adult years, where I have more manage of it because of the work that I've done in therapy, because of the, you know, medication that I'm on to help to just help out, level out the balance, or the imbalance that's in my brain, you know, so that I can use these tools in a more accessible way, rather than like waiting until I'm in that crisis moment and feeling like I can't do anything. Yeah.
Right. Right. And a perception that I think is important to mention too, is that what, you know, the real deep sustaining work is best done when we're actually in a really good place.
Yes.
When we're not coming into crisis, need stability. Right? That is the time to do that beautiful, deep emotional work that can then sustain us the next time something is more activated.
Yeah, absolutely. Right? Like, because it's impossible to even, or it's not impossible, it's very difficult, I think, when we're in that heightened state to think about what possibilities or what tools could work, because we're just so caught up in the moment, in that crisis and that, you know, level of anxiety where it's like, no, nothing's going to work. Like, why should I even try it? It's like, well, but if you work on the tools when you're not in that state, it just becomes so much easier to integrate, you know, just speaking from personal experience. But I mean, it's validating to hear you echo that as well.
Yeah.
Oh my goodness.
Yeah, absolutely.
I also wanted to ask you again, I feel like we keep, you know, coming back to narcissism, which is totally fine with me.
Yes.
But I have all these little questions that I'm like, okay, then we get on onto this topic and let's come back to narcissism. I was curious, in your research and your studies and your expertise, like, can narcissism breed narcissism? So like do narcissistic parents often have narcissistic children, or do you see that they tend to really like try to break away from that? Like, what have you seen in your experience with that kind of path?
I think both. You know, I often encourage folks to kind of look at the generational trickle down of the narcissistic tendencies and traits in the family. And let's remember too that some sort of personality disorder is born of childhood trauma, right? So that's the root cause is childhood trauma. And I use trauma with a big T or a little T.
Yeah.
So it is sometimes more likely that if we have a narcissistic parent, we're going to maybe ourselves have some cluster B traits or full on cluster B personality disorders, or a sibling, right? Because there can be genetic hereditary traumas that have been imprinted. I do absolutely believe that it is inevitable that if we've been raised in a narcissistic family system, that we ourselves are not, we're going to have narcissistic traits.
Yeah.
Narcissistic qualities. It's inevitable because it's just been projected from day one there. So I always encourage folks also to just take a look at that, to let's explore that. And just, you know, work. I do a lot of work in internal family systems, or parts work as it's called. So let's talk to those parts that maybe have the same activating circumstances or reactions that the narcissistic parent did. You know, a big question that I get a lot of the time is, well, am I a narcissist? And I often say, like, if you can ask that question, chances are.
Yeah.
Because I don't really know narcissist, full-blown textbook narcissist that would ask the question, am I a narcissist? Because I think it doesn't even phase them, right? But if we can ask those questions, great. Chances are no. But there may be the imprint of certain qualities that we want to just take a look at.
Yeah. I was listening to your podcast, and in one of the episodes where you're talking about, you know, like is narcissism everywhere? Because, you know, people, now that they're more aware of the term, like they're starting to pick up on it and see it more. And something that you brought up in the podcast is about healthy narcissism. And healthy narcissism blew my mind. I was like, what? That makes so much sense. But I never thought about it in that way. You know, like healthy narcissism seems like it can be where a lot of confidence and risk taking can come in to play. Mm-hmm. But when we think of narcissism, or at least what I thought before listening to your podcast episode, was narcissism was exclusively like a negative thing. Like you did not want to be a narcissist. If you were, you were like one of the worst kinds of people, like all of that. So to hear about the other part of that spectrum where there can be a healthy portion of it, I was like, what? So please educate me more, educate my audience. Like I am just dying to hear more about this.
Yeah. I mean, I think I'll go back to just saying that we all have and have narcissistic tendencies, right? We can all be self-involved at times.
Yeah.
It's about awareness. It's about knowing, wow, okay, when, let's say my spouse, my partner goes away for the weekend, I can see my parts really getting activated in that and being like this fear of abandonment coming up for me, right? So it's just awareness around that, I think. But then there are traits that we can use. I mean, I always, you and I were just talking briefly before recording, but you know, I'm thinking in terms of Harry Potter, right? Like I'm a Hufflepuff, but secretly I really want to be a Slytherin because I don't see anything wrong with being ambitious at times or striving for perfection or pushing yourself. Not, I shouldn't say striving for perfection because I'm going to strike that. No, but striving to be like, to give yourself the best opportunities you can, right? Mm-hmm. Like I think healthy ambition and work ethic and all of that can be good at times, right? Definitely. But it's just like that balance. And then how we are treating other people in that equation too.
Yeah.
I don't know if that quite...
No, for sure. It definitely does. And it's so funny that you bring up, you know, the Harry Potter element of, you know, like the houses, because my son, he still likes Harry Potter, but he went through like a heavy Harry Potter phase where it was like all Harry Potter all the time, as many kids do. And when we were doing more research into the different houses, and of course, he was constantly asking, like me and my husband, you know, which house we think that we would be part of, reading the descriptions, like not thinking about the characters, I was like, oh, yeah, Slytherin, that sounds like me. I feel like my sense of drive and determination and, you know, just wanting to excel at the things that I enjoy doing. I don't want to be Draco. Like, I'm no Draco Malfoy by any means. That's not what I'm striving for. But like Slytherin on paper, yeah, I could be all about that. Meanwhile, my son's like, Gryffindor all the way. I'm like, of course, but that's fine. Gryffindor does align with him. So props to that. But oh my goodness. So,
you know, and taking up space, right? Like, that could be included in there, in that sort of healthy kind of narcissism. Sorry to interrupt you there.
No, please. It's okay. I mean, yeah, just being comfortable with taking up space. And I think some of the episodes that were given on the podcast episode of yours that I was listening to were also, even starting a podcast is a form of healthy narcissism because you're like, yeah, people want to hear what I have to say. And obviously there are times when many of us who host podcasts might be like, who wants to hear what I have to say? But you keep going and you move forward with that sense of healthy narcissism, be like, somebody's going to benefit from this. And I'm the one that can give that to them. You know, starting your own business, I feel like, is the form of healthy narcissism too. Right. And it's just really wild to kind of think about narcissism in that way. It never crossed my mind before. So when I tell you I had these like major mind-blowing light bulb moments, hearing you talk, it's just, it's amazing.
Thank you.
Oh my gosh, of course. So What do boundaries look like for an adult child of a narcissist? Like how can they really create healthy boundaries and still have a relationship with their parent? Can they still have a relationship with their parent? Like what does that look like in terms of the realm of boundaries?
Yeah. I mean, it's a big, huge question, right? Because I think that's what is so muddled in a narcissistic family system are boundaries.
Yeah.
You know, there's no beginning or ending to the narcissist and the child. So it's, and the boundaries that do appear generally only appear for the narcissist. So it's very mm-hmm. confusing, very mixed messaging. So I usually just offer like people considering things to start with, mm-hmm. like, how would it be to consider, you know, calling your narcissistic mother 3 times a week versus every day? Or do you know what I mean? Like, we're just playing around with, well, what would it be like to consider, you know, being on your phone an hour less? We're just experimenting with what that might feel like to be okay with setting boundaries that feel comfortable, feel reasonable and manageable.
Yeah.
Remembering too that boundaries are neutral. We can set them and then we don't have to really do anything else. Yeah. We can't control what happens on the other side of them. You know, we can't tell people what to do. We cannot predict how they're going to react, what they're going to say. We can't control any of that. We can just work within ourselves. So I often too say to folks, like, the work is here, not out here. And even that can be an example of setting a boundary, right? Like when we don't put everybody else first and caretake for everybody else, and we find the time to caretake for ourselves, even if it's like a half an hour or whatever, that is the start of setting boundaries. So it doesn't have to be like hardcore, concrete, all at once, you know, cold turkey. We're just playing around with the idea of what that even feels like is kind of how I like to start folks off.
Yeah, as I feel like it has to start kind of small like that and just seeing how it feels in the body, right? Before you put it out into the world and start making those changes. Because I'm sure for a lot of folks, like when you mention like, well, how would that feel? There's probably a lot of internal resistance that comes up at first or discomfort. You know, like I could like feel that in my chest, you know, where it's like, ooh, how would that feel? Yeah. Like, oh, like it's that resistance because it's doing something different from what you've always done. And it's taking a step towards making yourself more of a priority. And for a lot of folks who really like live in that caretaker role, whether they're parents, like whether they have kids or they are just, you know, an adult child of narcissist, you know, without having children, that can be a really difficult thing to step away from because of the weight that is that occurs from being that caretaker. And it can be easier to put your energy and your focus on someone else rather than creating a healthy boundary, taking a step back and allowing yourself to think about your own needs when you've ignored them for so long.
Yes.
Whew.
Absolutely. And starting small, it doesn't have to be everything all at once. And then I really love to explore, okay, what's the reaction, right? Like, what is that? Let's sit with that feeling in the chest for a moment. Let's see what comes up around that. I'm always really intrigued by that rather than even the content of the situation we're talking about.
Yeah, absolutely. Because the internal things that are coming forward for you, I think, can speak so much clearer and even like loudly about how you're experiencing all of these emotions rather than talking about the like the external of it or the worry of that other person, you know, the narcissist that you're dealing with. It's like, okay, well, it's beginning that process, right? Of changing the direction of the energy to put it more towards yourself. And that's, yeah, I can totally see how that's really an important place to start. Wow.
Yeah. The work starts. I always, it's right here and it's all here. It's already in there. We just have to, you know, sift it out.
Exactly. And that's what I tell my clients too. And, you know, and within their finding their confidence and finding their style, like it's already there. You just kind of need to like let it out. You just need to allow it to breathe and show up and give yourself that permission to explore it, to explore like who you want to be in creating that safe space to do it. And it's not always easy.
Yeah. Not at all. It's really hard work. And I say that to folks too. A lot of times it's going to feel worse before it feels better. You know.
Yeah.
That means that change is afoot, right? Like something is going.
Yes, exactly. I feel like the day after there's been a big change, I think that that's when a lot of that discomfort kind of comes to the surface, where it's like, okay, I made the decision. I'm going to do the thing and it's going to be great. And today is the day I'm doing the thing. I'm feeling great. And then the day after you're like, oh shit, I did the thing. Like, and even if in like a therapy session, right? Like I'm going to go to my appointment. We're going to talk about all the things and we talk about all the things. And then it's either like right after the appointment or like the day after where all the healing is starting and you've realized that you've taken a step on a path that is leading you to change. And that's really powerful for a lot of folks, but also really scary too. I could continue to talk to you all day. I am so grateful for having you on and you sharing your wisdom and everything. We are going to include all of your links to everything in the show notes, but can you share with the audience like the best way to kind of learn more about you, to, you know, find your book, your podcast, all of that good stuff?
Absolutely. Thank you. And it's been a real pleasure and honor. So, and I feel the same. I can sit here and continue all day long, but that's, you know, people a day long podcast, but yeah. So at alisastamps.com is my website and just a little bit about my podcast. So I was doing the podcast with a co-host who has decided not to continue. So I have taken the podcast on solo. So it's a little tricky to find because it almost looks like a brand new podcast, but it is under the same name, Am I the Crazy One? And I do have two episodes that have come out. So you just kind of search for the title, I think. But then if you go on my website or Instagram, which is alisastamps.therapist, there are links to listen to the new Am I the Crazy One podcast. So feel free to check that out. Amazing. And then my book is available like Amazon, Barnes & Noble, but you can also go on my website and find it there pretty easily. So,
wonderful. Yeah. Thank you so, so much, Alisa. I really appreciate having you on and sharing your wisdom and everything. This episode was incredible. Thank you.
Thank you so much. It's been a real pleasure.
Of course. Thanks for taking the time to listen. The best way to support this podcast is to subscribe and leave a rating and review wherever you listen to podcasts.